And in this session, I want to begin introducing you to a book called Habits of the Heart, which was published in the middle of last year. And as the subtitle says, Individualism and Commitment in American Life, a short summary of what the book's about. I mentioned at dinner time some of the issues that the book raises. And I'll tell you what I want to do tonight. I want to speak briefly about some of the values that are common to all Americans that this book brings out. The book has done this through a series of interviews that it did with a cross-section of Americans. And it's impossible for me in a session like this to bring out the full richness of what's in this book. It touches on almost every area of our lives and our thoughts. And what makes it so meaningful is it's, for most of us, we're embedded in this culture to a much greater extent than we think. And when we read about ourselves in this book, we find that how common our culture is. I want to talk a little bit about what those values are that are common to all Americans and look a little bit at their historical roots. And then spend the rest of the time talking about how individuals imbued with those values relate today to important areas of their life. For example, the area of what we call finding oneself. You know, we leave our families, we go out into the world, we try to find ourselves. How people relate to love, marriage, how people relate to the church, and of great importance, maybe even the most important, how people relate to work. I was torn between just using or approaching this as trying to give you all the information that's in this book as possible. And I thought, well, boy, that's impossible. And then I thought, well, maybe just a few issues and then we could discuss them. So we'll see how it goes. I don't know how tired you are or how interested you are in the subject matter, but I hope I can ask questions, and if you feel that you want to respond, go right ahead, and I'm expecting you to do that. I put on the board here, this is called How Not to Plan Ahead. I hope it's not too small. I thought I was going to have a lot more open idea. But there's actually not, when we talk about individualism in American life, we're talking about a tradition that's not just of one cloth. We're talking about actually four types of individualism that have important historic roots. What's called biblical individualism, what the authors call biblical individualism, civic individualism, utilitarian individualism, and expressive individualism. So I'll talk about those as we go along. The values that I'm sure you can guess, you know, what values if people said, you know, like when you went to kindergarten and first grade and you learned about what it was to be an American and what America stood for. Maybe you can remember this, but these are the types of things that people related to when they were asked about the important things in their lives. And basically, they boil down to these: success and basically success in a kind of a middle class, or what we would call a middle class definition. If I ask you what's middle class, what would you respond? Let me give you a little background. When sociologists go out and ask people what social class they belong to, almost everybody belongs to the middle class. People say middle class. They don't say lower class because that's kind of a pejorative term. So sometimes sociologists call some types of people working class folks. And then we have the rich, you know, or the super rich. And of course, they will want to identify themselves as that. But what does it mean to be middle class? Have you ever thought about that? It's a term that's used, you know, quite a bit. I'm sure you run into it all the time. European sociologists, and in the tradition of sociology, try to bring the concepts of class into American culture to try to explain them, and it's really difficult to do, because European culture has the tradition of monarchy and nobility, which we don't have, and so that changes the meanings of class. Sometimes they can be applied in just a straight, arbitrarily applied income, or meaning through talking about income. You know, the people that make the most are upper class, people that make the least are working class, and then the people in the middle class. But people really do identify themselves as middle class. And what are they talking about?
Are you asking us, George?
Yeah, do you have any ideas? What would you say if I, you know, were to ask you that question, which I just did?
I guess middle class would be, to me, being fairly comfortable, having enough to eat and having your needs met and being comfortable, but yet still seeing something else as being better, wanting a little bit more.
Okay. I think that, you know, that's the last thing you said there is probably the key, because it's possible to be comfortable at a variety of income levels. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about here at Holden Village, you know, we're awful comfortable. But you know, if you fill out your income tax and say how much do you make, it probably wouldn't reflect your comfortability, the degree of comfortability that you have. But I think what middle class means for people is the idea of not being satisfied with your present condition, of seeking some kind of economic progress, at least attempting to, even if it isn't there, even if it doesn't come, at least trying. To say that, well, I'm comfortable and I'm where I am, and I'm not going to strive to achieve anymore, probably would be indicative of what we might call working class. And then you have the upper classes, which don't have to work and are comfortable because of their high income levels to begin with. I struggled for a long time in my career trying to figure out why it was that, especially in the 1960s and the middle 70s, that marijuana had such a bad name. Of course, it was associated with jazz musicians, you know, and Mexican-Americans, you know, those types of folks. But then it became used quite a bit by the American middle-class youth, and there was even movements to legalize it, but they were roundly unsuccessful. And it finally dawned on me, not, you know, directly through my reading and so on and understanding of the issue, that what had happened was that marijuana had become associated with the absence of this striving. The people associated with dropping out of the race, and this is the thing that parents, you know, are so scared of, you know, that their children will not take up the baton and improve their position. And so if their child is using marijuana, that's a sign that, uh-oh, they've dropped out. They're not going to be or strive to improve themselves. So success is a value that people hold very near and dear. And you see, how do you measure success? How do you know when you're successful? When do you say, well, I'm a success? That's it. Now, how do we tell who's a success and who isn't a success? It's difficult these days. What is the measure that we use?
Depends what circles you're in.
Well, it certainly does. But I mean, I'm talking about it in terms of a broad cultural perspective.
Job.
It might be job. Yeah, income. But it's hard to know, you know, what people make. Maybe you've had this experience if you've been in urban centers lately. There seems to be a lot more limousines than there ever were before. But when I was a kid, you saw a limousine and somebody famous was in that limousine, you know, and you wondered who it was. Today, you know, you see a limousine and some average person, you know, looks just like you and me, that steps out. The problem of how to tell, you know, who has it made and who hasn't got it made is a difficult one. I think what we use quite a bit is our consumption habits, and a sign of success, for example, for a breadwinner or a family leader, is how well off and what level of consumption their children and the other members of their family has. You know, we went through this Christmas season, and we see this total flip-flop of the meaning of Christmas. You know, Christmas, the birthday of Jesus, the love and God's love entering in flesh into the earth, or onto the earth. And the meaning of Christmas, of course, now we've got to have a good selling season at Christmas. I was reading some figures about the percentage of merchandising and retailing that is done at Christmas time, and it's over half. In other words, department stores and so on expect Christmas time to make up over half of their profits, spending big and giving big. Another value is freedom. We all hold that freedom. Okay, what's freedom? What does it mean? What would, you know, not to you personally, because we probably have as many different definitions personally, but in the context of American culture, what do you think freedom is?
Fluidity. If you choose to make a change, you can.
Okay. To not have some authoritarian structure over you that tells you what to do. Being left alone.
Does it also mean a chance that you can get rich?
Okay. That gets into some of these meanings of individualism. The freedom to make as much money as you can. One historian marked a change in the reason immigrants came to the United States, beginning with the gold rush in California. Up to that time, people came to the United States to carve out a living, to make a living. After the gold rush, it changed. People came here to make their fortune, to get rich. So there is that meaning of freedom too. I think that's very strong. You notice how the meaning of freedom and success, as we define it and so on, undermines family life and undermines community life and promotes an individualism that makes it difficult to connect up to public life and to participation in public life. Another value that people expressed was justice, that they think of an important value in American culture is justice. Well, what's justice? I sound like Socrates, right? and whatever you say is going to be wrong. No, that's not right. Because what you say is going to be right, because you also have these, have been socialized too into this culture.
I get my piece of the pie.
Okay. To get what you deserve, or fairness, maybe something like that. To a lot of people, it means something like equal opportunity. You know, that each person has the opportunity as an individual to gain these other things like success, especially monetary success. But a lot of people are in political movements because they wish to bring about equal opportunity. But the other question, you know, is the political questions beyond that people hardly ever ask. And that's like, what would a society in which equal opportunity existed look like? What would be the distribution of resources if equal opportunity actually did exist? In a lot of courses I teach are in criminal justice, and that uses the word justice. But there, it has come to mean almost totally a procedural sense of justice, that everybody is subject to the same procedures. A substantive meaning of justice beyond that, like what really is justice, is sort of absent from public debate. And then there's the other meaning of justice too, which is, which in political science is referred to as distributive justice, that people get back what they have contributed. And there's been some political activity in that area, equal work for equal pay, and I can't remember the right offhand, what's the concept by which people in parallel positions, men and women, or women who are in parallel positions in the occupational structure would receive, what?
Comparable work.
Yeah, comparable work, that's it, or comparable wages or salary. Well, these values have very important and long-term historical roots in American society. As I mentioned at dinner, the first Puritan that set her or his foot on this land was interested in what's referred to as biblical individualism. Winthrop, who was the leader of the first colony of Puritans, said, if you've ever read his speech on the Mayflower just before they went onto the land, his City on the Hill speech, it was this idea that finally we have the freedom to what? The freedom to do good, to build a community in which the good, the pure, will prevail. Notice that this idea of biblical individualism is a community understanding of individualism. Republican, you know, and also that idea of biblical individualism is carried on in places like Holden Village. And the United States has a whole history of utopian communities that were centered on this vision of the freedom to pursue the good and what's worthwhile. The first civic individualism is associated with people like Thomas Jefferson. Civic individualism was the freedom, the democratic freedom, the ability of each individual to participate and give, at that time, his consent to the government. Again, this is a kind of individualism that ties the person to the society, to the wider society and community in which he or she is involved. Ben Franklin, who is another father of our country, if you know some of Franklin's writings, Franklin was not born into a privileged class. His father was quite poor, and he worked his way up and became successful. And he brought about this idea, and maybe you've heard of Poor Richard's Almanac, all these little mottos or sayings about how to get rich and save your money. A penny saved is a penny earned, you know, those kinds of things. It was associated with what we call utilitarian individualism. Now, there's a break between biblical and civic individualism and utilitarian and expressive individualism in United States history. It's that break that changes the definition of the idea of individualism from being a community-centered project to being a self-centered, self-interest project. So utilitarian individualism is the ability to make oneself a success, especially monetarily, materially. Now, expressive individualism has other important roots in American history, maybe associated with Walt Whitman. Expressive individualism, again, what it says, it's the ability to express the inner self, the emotions, to not have those censored, or to recognize the importance of individual ideas, works of art, music, poetry. Expressive individualism is still important to us today in some respects, and I'll get to those in a second. So, biblical individualism, civic individualism, gave way to utilitarian and expressive individualism, but for the first few decades of American history, these were tightly controlled by the fact that the individual was tied into a network of community relationships. The local entrepreneur did not have the freedom to make as much money as he or she wanted to. The reason was because they were controlled and restrained by the community in which they found themselves, small town America. Their status in that community coerced them to participate in community affairs and to be tied to the community. In small towns in the Midwest and the East, you still see, you know, statues in the middle of the town some that are statues of somebody who founded the town or contributed to the town. In the musical, The Music Man, Everything in town is named after this one person who gave the money for all of these things. That's what restrained individualism. The church, the family, the community, those are the important institutions that restrained untrammeled individualism. Well, of course, industrialization broke that up, and especially around the turn of the century, the entrepreneur became free to make as much money as they wanted to. The era of the robber barons and the major trusts. Well, what would take the place of broken communities? What came to be to be idealized in American culture to replace this community, a community of people at various levels and statuses that worked together for the benefit of the corporate body, was the family. And so in American literature, the family became very romanticized. It was this refuge from this public world. In terms of these latter two types of individualism, utilitarian and expressive, the way our economy and our society has progressed to today, two of the most important occupations that we have, and what the authors of this book consider to be the occupations that typify America these days, is the manager and the therapist. The manager is this person in the bureaucracy. And so much of our life is carried on between complex bureaucracies. The manager becomes the most important occupation. And how to get people to participate willingly and to go along with things. The other side, you know, their expressive selves. In other words, the parts that aren't just interested in making money or a job, but the emotional side of life. How to fit that in becomes the area in which the therapist does his or her work. Now, do you have any comments or any questions at this point? Because this is sort of the background that I wanted to do, and then get into how this history and these values affect us in our everyday life today. Do you have any questions about these terms up here? At all? Carolyn, you look.
Oh, I'll have to say this, but maybe I was trying to write, maybe I wasn't listening well enough. I just missed your final point on why do the manager and therapist typify American job values today?
Not job values, but typify the major concern of public and private life. I can better illustrate this by pointing to occupations that did this in the past. Probably in the middle 1800s, the American that best expresses the combination of farmer, citizen, person active in community life, and also stable in their occupational and family life was Abraham Lincoln. The gentleman from Illinois, who succeeded from transforming his small little situation there in the town, that he Springfield, Illinois, to actually becoming famous as President of the United States during the Civil War. And his career, I'm sure you all were imbued with that in your schooling, the career of Abraham Lincoln as being so exemplary of an American life. Now, the image today is the therapist and the manager, the exemplar of American life.
Does the manager go with the utilitarian individualism more so, and the therapist with the expressive individualism?
That's right.
More so?
That's right. These two types of individualism are very important to us, and that's really where most of our meaning of individualism lies. Now, the quintessential task of all Americans is to find oneself. Now, out of all the variations in child rearing and goals that people have and parents have for their children, what is it that typifies, or what is the goal of all parents? You know, I'm speaking in generalizations. But what are parents supposed to do with their children?
Educate.
Well, educate them, but for what?
Independence, self-sufficiency.
Right, independence, self-sufficiency.
Get them out of the nest.
Get them out of the nest. Get them so that they don't depend on anybody except themselves.
And be responsible citizens.
Right, whatever that means. Self-reliance. And parents, you know, oh, my kid's not self-reliant yet. You know, they still come home too much, you know, or they still depend on me. Leaving the nest and coming back, leaving and coming back, and then finally, you know, parents say, but there's a joke, you know, I have a horrible memory for jokes, but there's a joke about when some people are talking around saying, talking about abortion, and I say, well, when does life begin? And it's a conversation between a priest and a minister and a rabbi, and the priest says, at the point of conception, that's when life begins. And the minister says, well, no, it's, the point of quickening or something like that. You know, it's not important. But anyway, then they ask the rabbi is walking by, and they say, when does life begin? He says, when the children have left home and the dog is dead. Now, self-reliance, of course, is the ultimate conformity in America.
Can I just ask a question? It just surprised me that you said that. I always thought that didn't know that parents traditionally had been bringing their children up to be self-reliant. You know, this thing of saying, thank goodness they're self-reliant now. I assumed it was traditionally more the other way, that the parents wanted the children to be, didn't want them to be self-reliant, wanted them to be reliant on them and keep a close family unit through several generations, you know.
Yeah, I think that's an older ideal.
And take over as regards values and lifestyle. So I was thinking exactly the same.
It's
a model I know better.
Right. I think that's
interesting. You too clearly didn't grow up in America.
You know, that they point out, the authors point out that this image of child raising goes way back in U.S. history. And patriarchy never really, except in farm, you know, on the farm or in farm communities, patriarchy never really got going in this country, mainly because the Enlightenment writers, especially John Locke, associated with patriarchy with monarchy. The model of the family was the way that the monarch related to society, the way the father would relate. Well, when you do away with the monarchy, then this calls for a different kind of family style. And John Locke, wrote a book about that was very popular in the 1800s about child raising, and it was this idea that you're authoritarian with your children up to adolescence because you want them to have certain values. One of those values then is to become independent and equal. And at adolescence, the father begins treating his children as if they were friends. And co-equals. And that goes really back quite a long ways in American history. It's important. I was reading that there's now a specialty in counseling and psychotherapy toward breaking families up. That some families have a real trouble. You know, like parents don't, like you were saying, don't want their children to become independent, and they get scared. Children start expressing their own ideas. And so they try to clamp down hard on them. And that causes a lot of family friction. And so you call the counselor in who helps, you know, the parents see that it's time for their children to become independent and to leave home. Leaving the church is another tradition in American culture. It doesn't mean necessarily, it means forming your own religious ideas. your own religious attitudes. You may belong to the same church that your parents did, but you're supposed to not just accept your parents' religious ideas, you're supposed to form your own. And that's part of the of self-reliance too. Now, in terms of finding oneself, work has always been very important, not just in this culture, but other cultures too. And the problem with work in modern times is that it's the meaning of work has been broken up into at least three different parts. When we talk about work, we're talking about a job. Or how we make our money. We're also talking about a career, and that means the series of jobs or related activities that we go through within a lifetime. And then we're also talking about a calling. Martin Luther was very important in developing this concept in the German word Beruf, or calling. And what he meant was how our occupation relates us to the community, or what we do in our work life, how that relates us to the wider society, our family and community. Now, in terms of, you see what's happened with work, in small town America, or rural America, those three things could much more easily fall together, job, career, and work, or job, career, and calling. What people do as their job, they may not see as their calling, or their career may take, you know, a variety of directions that are difficult to see. The directions, it's difficult to see how they fit together. So the meaning of work becomes very difficult to understand these days, and the importance to people, especially when a lot of people have this value of success, but they don't have access to the work that can bring it about. What happens, you know, when people are trained, go to college? Incidentally, this is the way we normally, the middle class, has made their children self-reliant, is by sending them to college. And everything is supposed to, the other things are supposed to fall together then. They're supposed to find a career there, they're supposed to find another family, a marriage, they're supposed to find a calling. In terms of finding oneself, of course, in the term oneself is the concept self. And it's important to understand, too, how people constitute their selves or their idea about themselves these days. A lot of people have trouble finding meaning in their lives. And part of that is a problem with understanding who or what they are. What is it that we're to do with our lives? What is worthwhile to do with our lives? the therapist, this is where the therapist comes in and says, well, what, maybe some of you have taken a psychology class in college, have come across the idea of basic needs that people have. Erickson has developed a list of, I think, 10 basic needs. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, those types of things. See, they're supposed to help the therapist because the therapist can take the list and say, okay, where are you at? Where do we need to help you? But if you read those lists of needs, and they're things, the basic things, of course, are things like clothing, food, safety, and so on, but they build up as a person matures into more complex types of needs, need to love and to be loved, need to find meaning in one's life and to create and so on. I can't remember exactly what they are offhand, but they're those types of things. But if one realizes those needs, then one becomes a self-actualized person. But for what? You know, so one realizes those needs, then what? You know, what does one do with one's life? What is this self in modern American culture? Some sociologists like Irving Goffman have gone so far as to say there is no self. It's just a series of masks. And we put on a mask in one situation, we take that one off as we move to another situation and put another mask on. And there's really nothing there except those masks. What is the content of self? Well, I put these two concepts up here, the empty self and the constituted self. These are the words of the authors of this book. And what they're trying to get at is that if we follow the prescriptions that are given to us by the dominant culture toward the prescriptions for finding ourselves, we're likely to end up with what they refer to as an empty self. Because if we're only interested in self-actualization or self-interest, and if we pursue our interests and we cut our ties with those things that don't allow us to pursue our self-interest, like family and community and those types of things, then what do we end up with except our own desires? And our own desires are quite unstable. They change from time to time. And so what makes our desires any better than what they were yesterday? What makes them any more worthwhile than they were yesterday? And who knows what they're going to be tomorrow? And so that the self really dissolves when we start thinking about, is that self made up of things that are worthwhile and that can be defended? Why do this rather than that? And there is no such thing as a true empty self. This is what's referred to as an ideal type. There's no way that a person can cut themselves off completely from their background, that can completely forget about where they were born, who their parents were, what kinds of traditions they were taught. We can try to do that quite a bit, but we'll never really achieve that end. So there is no such thing as a true empty self. The constituted self, on the other hand, is the self that's made up that takes into account the traditions from which we came and looks at those as valuable. Something before us that we take up and then pass on or are part of a chain that's carried on. And these things come from virtues that our parents may have taught us, lifestyles that our parents led. It may come from ethnic and racial traditions, traditions that seek advancement and equality of our group. There are things that set us in history someplace. There are things that give us a past before us, before our time, and there are things that we see as possible to carry on after us too. This is what they refer to as the constituted self. And it's this type of self that has to be made up of some kind of social participation, involvement in family and community life, and political life too. Because those are the virtues that went before us. Let me read you a passage. This is a quote from a book by Gail Sheehy called Passages. maybe, it's probably, some, I'm sure some of you have read it because it was a very popular book a few years ago. But listen to this advice in the context of what I've been saying. Speaking of midlife, Gail Sheehy says, let go, let it happen to you, let it happen to your partner, let the feelings, let the changes. You can't take everything with you when you leave on the midlife journey. You are moving away, away from institutional claims and other people's agendas, away from external valuation and accreditations, in search of an inner validation. You are moving out of roles and into the self. If I could give everyone a gift for the send-off on this journey, it would be a tent for tentativeness, the gift of portable roots. To reach the clearing beyond, we must stay with the weightless journey through uncertainty. Whatever counterfeit safety we hold from overinvestments in people and institutions must be given up. The inner custodian must be unseated from the controls. No foreign power can direct our journey from now on. It is for us to find a course that is valid by our own reckoning. Now, I know that resonates with us, because the sense of finding ourselves is so strong in our culture. That what she's saying, we probably say, you know, there's probably a lot of truth to that. There's probably a lot of good advice there. But what kind of people will be running our country or our institutions that have that philosophy? That they're tentative, that what's here today is not there tomorrow, that you're ready to change any moment, you know, go this direction. What is there to hold on to? There's nothing to hold on to. How will that tie us to public life or civic life? How will that make us civic individuals or biblical individuals in this sense? It won't. But that's, you know, that's the kind of advice that a lot of people listen to, and it's the advice of therapy for therapists as they deal with people's emotional needs, to find oneself, to cut oneself off from any burden that others give us, or that we have received in the past. I was going to say, I noticed people are yawning. maybe I can skip up. I was going to say that that we have to face the fact that this is the kind of information and the kind of situation that we've come to in our culture. This is the kind of information or advice that people are listening to. And to simply return to some idealized past is not possible. You know, my joke, I have a jokey phrase, you know, that I say, you know, like, put women back in the family, you know. Well, they've been there. You know, and that's why they're not there anymore. you know, who shares the burden of, we have to deal with this in our institutions, who shares the burden of altruism or self-sacrifice in our culture? You know, women have said they don't want to do the job all by themselves any longer. Any and all surveys of satisfaction with the family show that women are less satisfied with the family than men. And It's not hard to see why, because they've had to shoulder the major burden in that area and suffer the consequences from the undermining of our families. Now, the authors look. I wanted to say a couple things. I'll skip over a lot here, but I wanted to say a few things about love and marriage, because I think they have some important points to make here too. There's a brilliant, you know, what? Why do people get married? What are the psychological reasons for getting married? Let's just deal with that.
Sexual? Fear.
The fear? In what sense?
Afraid of being alone.
Okay. I think that's really important. Sex would be a difficult one to say, you know, that except in a traditional sense that people get married for. Because most people have sex before they get married. And that
stays first.
You know, and I remember, you know, like, okay. But I think fear is really an important point here, that people want to find somebody else. They're scared of being alone. Now, so, there's a lot of, this this sense of fear or can be talked about it in a lot of other emotional senses too. They interview one therapist who says that, you know, she says that she spends most of her time helping people break up from their marriages. And her other patients are lonely, trying to find somebody. And that really struck me, because I thought, you know, I talk to a lot of people like that. You know, either they're unhappy, they want to get out of a marriage, or they're unhappy because they're alone and they want to find a marriage. And, you know, think about that and then think, what is the purpose of marriage? Are those psychological functions of marriage the same as the purpose of marriage? Now, what they uncovered in their interviews was a tremendous dichotomy between a secular understanding of love and marriage and a traditional Christian sense of marriage. For the secular understanding of marriage, the psychological purposes of marriage or the psychological reasons for marriage are probably the same as the purpose of marriage. For people, though, and especially from fundamentalist Christian backgrounds who they interviewed, they saw the purpose of marriage as something very, very different. What do you think they saw the purpose of marriage as?
To share and know God better, and their faith in themselves. And their
okay.
Children and family.
Okay. But for what reason? Or what? How does marriage promote children in the family? Well, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, I think Elmer talked about this last Sunday in his sermon when he was talking about love. That there's a difference between, you know, for Christians, love is not a set of feelings. But in our secular society, it is. What is love for a Christian? Love for a Christian is a commandment. It's an obligation. It's you do something. It's an act. It's not a feeling. And so love and marriage in a Christian context, it involves the obligation to love, the obligation, the duty to sacrifice. Now, you try to talk to the average person in our culture about that, and they'll put you in a loony bin. That is so far from the meaning of love and marriage in the secular context that it's an anathema. I mean, that is something that we're trying to run from and avoid. So you can see that with the secular understanding of marriage, there's going to be a lot of problems with trying to sustain marriage over a long period of time. It's a lot to keep those psychological reasons predominate. It's going to take a lot of hard work to do that. And a lot of people aren't willing to make that effort. But, you know, this may be something that I think that we're beginning to understand, too. That stable marriages mean going back to the well over and over again to try to maintain that meaning of, related to feeling. And especially then when therapists, the language of therapists, of course, is to love oneself, that you have to have respect and love for yourself before you can love others. And to find and accept oneself. And this is, I think, you know, what a lot of people go to counselors for, is to try to search for this acceptance of themselves.
Do you think that a marriage is also an attempt, you know, with the increasing absence of community and connectedness anywhere else, that people go to marriage with sort of the illusion that, well, okay, I can't find it anywhere else, but I'm going to find it in this relationship?
That's right. I think that's really an important point to understand, that I can broaden it and say that, and the authors point this out, that what has taken the place of community for people? What functions as community today? Now, what functions as community is what they refer to as lifestyle enclaves, which have to do with, of course, lifestyle and consumption patterns. But the problem with lifestyle enclaves, and the family, is also a lifestyle enclave for a lot of people. It's this refuge, the thing that they go back to, that they can count on, maybe, you know, that they can invest themselves in. They found that a lot of men and women would, in their careers, they'd take up a job, and in that career they would be promoted, and then they'd level out, and they'd realize that they're probably going to stay in that, pretty much in that same position, and they're not going to get what they had been getting from work, that the sense of self-accomplishment that they had before. And so it's at that point that they turn toward their families as a refuge, and as another place to find meaning. In other words, not just a refuge, but as a place to find meaning in their lives. But the problem with lifestyle enclaves as a substitute for community is that they don't relate us to public life. Because the community was the thing that brought people at various levels, various occupations, lower class, working class, middle class, upper class, together in a common enterprise. Lifestyle enclaves, on the other hand, happen to be made up of people that are pretty much alike and don't relate to other people that aren't alike, like them. I think probably the best, in a sense, the best example, but also the worst example, are retirement communities. Finally, the person gets to a point in their career when they can move to Sun City and be just like other people, like themselves. But you know what's so shallow about those places is they have no past, they have no tradition, they have no future. A lot of people like them, maybe for that reason, but they really are isolated and don't relate to the rest of the society. I think, you know, that's a good point that you brought up about the family.
George, you needed to help me sort this out a little bit. I think I hear you doing two different things, or the author is doing two different things. One is descriptive work, demographic or historical. And then the other one, that there's some kind of a polemic going on.
What
is the polemic?
Uh-huh.
There's an argument. When you talk about retirement communities and you talk about it as shallow, that's an evaluative term, which no longer is demographic or descriptive. Is now the authors are not just interviewing people, but making value statements about what they're hearing or what they see. Those are two different things that seem to be.
Okay, you're right. They do both things. Because they wrote this book for a purpose, and that's this polemic. The idea is that some, you know, that if we want to, which is their idea, if we want to save these values that we cherish, the integrity of the individual, participation in government, the consent of the governed, the ability to bring about in the society the kind of society that we want, how do we preserve and promote that? And what they found was that people in their individual lives, nobody's asked what's meant by habits of the heart. But what they're referring to is that but there still is this sense of obligation. There still is this sense of social duty. And you find people doing it all around you. But if you ask them why they do it, they can't explain it. And that's what they mean by habits of the heart. It's their heart working. It's not the way they're making sense out of their lives. Because the language of individualism is so predominant in our culture that it's hard to explain it, why people do anything, except by saying, because it makes me feel good. Or, it's just what I want. Or, that's my priority. It's a self-interest explanation. But why people do things, obligations and self-sacrifice, in terms of tradition, and meanings of life outside of themselves and to something higher and more important beyond them, is a language that's really difficult for people to use. You know, I find this so true in my own life, you know. And a friend of mine says, hey, come on over and watch the 49ers. And I say, well, I'm going to church. And, you know, they don't say, I say, you know, like, I can't until after church or something like that. And then they don't say, why do you go to church? Because I think they probably expect the answer, I just feel more centered, you know, or it's makes me feel good, or I get something out of it. But in terms of going to church as some kind of an obligation and promoting some good that's higher and beyond oneself, I don't think people really would understand that so much, unless you're in a community of believers themselves. You know, so it is a plentiful work.
If this is something of a natural unfolding, if there's a almost inevitable progression in this, then is their attempt to salvage it really inconsistent with what they're observing?
Their attempt to salvage?
Yeah, their attempt to change the course of history.
Well,
which...
No, what they're saying is that I tried to introduce this at supper tonight, is that this language of individualism is what they refer to as the first language. It's the one that's the primary language, it's the one that most of us use. Now, against this individualism is also associated with political liberalism. And against this liberalism has arisen this conservative orthodoxy that says, here, you know, are these past truths and ways of doing things, and let's reinstitute them. And it's this, and Ronald Reagan, of course, is the epitome of that. And, you know, if you look at Ronald Reagan's own biography, what he preaches is a total hypocrisy. During the last campaign, when he put down Geraldine Ferraro for her views on pro-choice as undermining the family, and he says, you know, I'm against abortion. I uphold the family. Look at his own biography. What a joke. You know, but what he's doing is, of course, trying to get votes. And what he's appealing to is this idealized image of past America. And what he's saying is that public life or government is solely for the purpose of having peace in the realm so people can pursue their economic interests. All other interests are for the private life outside of the public realm. Family life, work, you know, those types of things don't have anything to do with government. And they shouldn't have anything to do with government. And if promoting social welfare, the social welfare, helping the poor, making solid communities, and government doesn't have anything to do with that. That's for private citizens in their private realm. And if that's followed through, of course, we end up with, you know, where does authority come from then, except you know, from some strong power outside ourselves, so that we lose these values, we undermine these values that such as freedom and civic participation. Now, is that helpful with that, or are you troubled?
Well, I just don't understand it well enough, know enough about their position to say whether what they're arguing for.
Oh, what they were trying to do is revive this language of what they refer to as biblical and civic individualism.
Okay, my question is it really revivable?
Well, now, I wanted to save that for the next
presentation,
because what I'm talking about tonight is private life.
Yeah.
And there's this other realm of public life that has to do with politics, the economy, religion, and so on. And then they end the book with their last chapter is titled Transforming American Culture. So, and what they do there is look at these areas of American life where the second language of individualism is still alive and being pursued. and look at the possibilities, or some of the possibilities, for making it stronger. They go into changes that have taken place in the area, and the meaning of friendship and reaching out to others. In a quick summary, they sort of say what's happened to friendship is that the model of friendship is also the model of the therapist-client relationship. That we choose our friends in terms of their therapeutic possibilities for us. That, you know, our friends are supposed to do something for us. Like we choose a therapist, you know, to help us with problems in our lives. And then finally, in this, to end up this section, they summarize this whole concept of individualism. And if you've had a course in American literature, maybe you've come across this notion of the mythic individualism in American literature, specifically the cowboy hero, and probably the Lone Ranger is the best example, and the detective story, Raymond Chandler stories especially. The cowboy, you see, you know, incidentally, the longest enduring symbol in American advertising history is the Marlboro Man. Mm-hmm. And why does the Marlboro Man strike Americans, you know, so right in the heart? You know, why do we relate to that so much? You notice that, you know, if you, next time you look at a Marlboro ad with the Marlboro, you know, the scene there, notice that there's no civilization. There's a purity of nature depicted that civilization sees somehow sullies and pollutes. There's no women. Again, women are associated with civilization, which is unnatural. And I'm talking about, you know, this is very strong in American cultural history. And just look at our embrace of the cowboy. You know, especially the cowboy hero, the person who's separate. You know, remember the Lone Ranger, he's always outside of town. And there's a problem in town. And he comes and solves that problem, but he can't be a part of that because he doesn't want to get dirty. He goes back out where he can be pure, and his, you know, his clothes are always clean and white.